Welcome back to the Men's Afternoon Kollel. Learning, at least for now, virtually together, but still learning, most importantly, and it's great to be together. Thank you so much for joining this afternoon. As always, we're grateful to the Froelich Financial Group for sponsoring the robust Men's Afternoon Kollel. And as always, a huge thank you to Rabbi Simi Shabtai, our Rosh Kollel, Rosh Beis Medrash, who, by the way, not only has not allowed our programming to rest or fall back during these unusual times, but has given you and all of us access to great Talmidei Chachamim from around the world, has somehow gotten them to agree to teach within our Kollel. And so, Rabbi Shabtai, a huge thank you. We're going to pick up where we left off last week, and that is the continuation of the topic of the study of the intersection of Kabbalah and Halacha. We're rapidly approaching Lag BaOmer, which is associated with Rav Shimon Bar Yochai. And again, whether he's the author of the Zohar or not is a scholarly topic and debate, not for now. For the purposes of a Men's Afternoon Kollel, we are presuming that he is the author of the Zohar, the Halakh Zohar. And so last week we began to analyze and investigate this question of what is the intersection of Halacha and Kabbalah? What role does Kabbalah have within Halacha? We set it up with really analyzing that rationalists, Maimonidean scholars, like to assume that we are above mysticism. We don't live with transcendence. We don't live with the influence of the mystical world, of the world of that which is nister. But what we've shown thus far and will continue to develop is that in all aspects of halacha, sometimes there's a debate and friction between the revealed and the hidden Torah. Sometimes the hidden Torah is actually complementing or adding customs or practices to the revealed Torah that we're not even familiar with without it. However, what we see is that it has an important voice and an influence within the area of the development of halacha for all people of all hashkafas and orientations. There is an important say that Kabbalah has within halacha. So we began with the introduction of the Beis Yosef. We gave a whole history of the Beis Yosef, which we won't review right now, but of Yosef Karo in the 15th, early 16th century, who in the introduction talks about to his Beis Yosef, his magnum opus, his commentary on the Torah, describes how he came to his halachic conclusions. And among the many, many, many commentators and influences and authorities that he weighs, including Rashi, Tosfos, the Ran, the Rif, the Rash, the Mocher, the Rambam, and so on and so forth, the ends of Ktzas Mekomos, Ma'amare HaZohar. The Beis Yosef, Rav Yosef Karo, the great author of the Shulchan Aruch himself, tells us that he references and he quotes, and we saw that he had a great familiarity and a working knowledge of the Zohar, the great authoritative work of Jewish mysticism. We saw he incorporates the Zohar into halachic practice. For example, there's machlokas Rosh and Rashba, whether when you wash your hands from Negelvasser, can you wash it onto the ground, or it has to be collected in a vessel. We know that when it comes to the halachas of washing your hands for hamotzi, there's a stringency, it has to be in a vessel, not on the ground. Do we apply that standard to Negelvasser washing in the morning as well? And we saw the Beis Yosef had a discussion where in the revealed Torah, in the Torah Sanigla, there was no reason you had to be strict, and yet within the Torah Sanister, he was, and he incorporates that in. We then saw his principle. What happens when there's a contradiction? What happens when there's a tension between Kabbalah and Halacha, between Nigla and Nister? And we saw his uncle, Rav Yitzchak Karo, in the Shut Beis Yosef, he quotes his uncle in a tshuva that if Kabbalists disagree with the Gemara, we reject their ruling, we follow the Gemara. If they side with one view in the post-Talmudic debate, then we will allow Kabbalah to decide. So if the Gemara is conclusive, and the Gemara's conclusion is opposite Kabbalah, then we follow the Gemara, not Kabbalah. But if the Gemara is inconclusive, and if the Gemara leaves it as a debate with two sides, then we'll allow Kabbalah to weigh in and put one side over the top, then over the other. We saw this in the area of tefillin, and we can digress momentarily if you like. I said we would talk about it more at another time, and there's a lot more to talk about, but we can digress at least superficially to talk about the area of that debate. Do you make one bracha on tefillin, one bracha on the tefillin shel yad and the tefillin shel rosh, or do you make two different brachas? What should be the practice? We'll come back to that in a moment. We saw if, however, Kabbalah goes against the Gemara, we reject Kabbalah. And the example of that was this question of how many brachas to make on tefillin. We also saw, and this is how we ended last time, Kabbalah is a primary source sometimes for certain practices. I'm going to share the screen now. We could all be looking at the same source sheets inside. Do you see the source sheets right now? Somebody give me a thumbs up. Jonathan, you see the source sheets? Thank you. Okay, good. I think Rabbi Shabtai shared them as well. You should be able to find them online. So we saw all these sources I'm flying through, but there were three areas. Let's make this a little smaller. Three areas where the Kabbalah, in fact, is the primary source for a practice that we don't find in the halacha elsewhere. The first example was Leviim washing the Kohanim's hands. We take it for granted, universally, in every shul, Ashkenazim, Svaradim, Leviim wash the hands of Kohanim. And yet, this has no basis, no source in the revealed Torah, in the revealed halacha. Kabbalah introduced it, and yet we observe it, not in times of pandemic, where even the Israel allowed Minyanim to resume. But Birchas Kohanim, that happens daily in Israel, Israel instructed Leviim are not to wash the hands of the Kohanim. We don't want to have many people touching cups and pouring water from one to another. But in normative times, when we're safe to practice, universally the practice is for Leviim to wash the hands of Kohanim, and this finds itself not in the Torah Sanigla, in the revealed Torah, but rather in the Torah Sanister. Number two, women not going to a funeral. And number three, having 12 windows in a shul. Shulchan Aruch records that a person, the Shulchan Aruch says, we know that we have open windows facing Yerushalayim, the spalal kenegdan to daven opposite them, the tovshiu bebeis haknesses, yud beis chalonis. And it's good to have a practice of shul like we do, to have 12 windows. It doesn't say how many of them should be stained glass, Jonathan Charm. It just says 12 windows. So we have that in our shul. Where does this come from? 12 windows. I might have thought it corresponds with the 12 Shvatim, that we have diversity and unity, the motto of our community. A shul should reflect that. 12 windows, 12 entrances, 12 rays of light, 12 different tribes. But that's not the reason. If you look in the Beis Yosef, you'll see the reason is B'sefer HaZohar, Parshas Pekudei, Sibas Sod Nichmas. It comes from Kabbalah, a very deep sentiment, a very deep thought of Kabbalah. So we see that sometimes Kabbalah complements halacha, sometimes Kabbalah contradicts halacha, sometimes Kabbalah, in fact, adds on practices that the halacha itself did not have and did not incorporate. So let's go back for a moment before we continue to this question of tefillin, because I promised you last time that we would. What is this debate exactly? Ashkenazim today still, we make, hopefully we all put on our tefillin this morning, and how many brachas did we recite on the tefillin that we put on? We said two brachas. Laniach tefillin on the tefillin of the arm, and al mitzvah's tefillin on the tefillin of the head. Svaradim make only one bracha on both al mitzvah's tefillin. What is the nature of this debate? Where does this debate come from? So, to go back, the Machaber of Yosef Karo, Shulchan Aruch Paskins, like Rashi, the Rif, and the Rambam. Rashi, the Rif, and the Rambam all say to make one bracha, and that is how the Beis Yosef Paskins. This is not in the source sheets, I'm telling it to you outside. The Ramah says, no, we follow Rabbeinu Tam and the Rush. Rabbeinu Tam and the Rush are of the opinion that you make two separate brachas. Where does this come from? So each one has a Gemara that supports their conclusion. The Gemara Brachas of Das Samach, again, it's not in your source sheets. Again, we'll look at this more comprehensively another time, but I just wanted to, last week some asked me more for the basis of this. The Gemara Brachas is a solid support for the Ashkenazi practice, the practice of the Ramah, Rabbeinu Tam, and the Rosh. Why? Because the Gemara in Brachas on Daf Samach, those learning the Daf should still remember, less than 100 days ago, that the Gemara there tells us the order of the brachas that we recite when we wake up in the morning, and it instructs us when you put the tefillin on the arm, the bracha of lahaniach is recited. When you put the tefillin on the head, the bracha of al mitzvah's tefillin is recited. So it's often in the Gemara, it's pefeirish in the Gemara, it's explicit in the Gemara, that what? There are two brachas. You put the bracha of the tefillin on the arm, you make a bracha of the tefillin on the arm, and you put the tefillin on the head, you make a bracha of the tefillin on the head. So that's a big support for Rabbeinu Tam and the Rush, for the Ramah, the Ashkenazi practice, Ashkenazi authorities who say, you see the Gemara explicitly says two brachas, that's our practice, two brachas. However, the Gemara in Menachos, and Daf Lamed Vav Amad Aleph, the Gemara in Menachos tells us, no, if you did not talk between the Tefillin Shel Yad and Tefillin Shel Rosh, you only say one bracha. If you interrupted, you add a second bracha. That's what the Gemara says. So the Svaradim point to this and say, you see, that when is it you say the two brachas that the Gemara in Brachos was talking about? If you interrupted, you put the tefillin on the arm, and the Mirtz Hashem, B'mehir Rav Yameinu, will be back together in person. Your friend will walk in, and they'll say, how are you? I haven't seen you in 2 months. How'd you do? How'd you make out? How are you feeling? And you put the tefillin of the arm, and you're going to interrupt it before the tefillin of the head, and you make a hefsik. So when you make a hefsik, says the Gemara Menachos, that's when you add a second bracha for the tefillin of the head. But if you didn't make a hefsik, then taka, there is only one bracha. So both the Mechaber and the Ramah, both the Ashkenazi and Sephardi authorities, the Rashi, Rif, and the Rambam on the one hand, Rabbeinu Tam and the Rosh on the other, each have a Gemara to point to, and each use that Gemara to try to prove their position regarding how many brachas you make on tefillin. Now, it's interesting. The Ramah hedges his bet. We know we have the practice of saying Baruch Shem Kvod after the bracha of Al Mitzvah's Tefillin, in case we're wrong, in case in fact it's extra. We hedge. When you say Baruch Shem, you can undo the possibility that you took God's name in vain. So what we do is we put the head tefillin on, we say the bracha, we tighten it in order to fulfill, if the bracha is falling on the mitzvah, we want to do the mitzvah properly. And after the head tefillin is tightened, hopefully in the correct place, then we say Baruch Shem to hedge, to make sure that we did not in fact make a bracha livatala. Now, a question, which we're not going to get into right now, but I pose it to you, our esteemed Men's Afternoon Kolal, is why does the Ramah hedge here? We have many areas of halacha that are subject to debate, machlokas, and it's unclear which position to take, and yet the Ramah conclusively takes a position and goes in all the way. And yet here, though the Ramah could conclusively paskin, like Rabbeinu Tam and the Russians say, two brachas, no looking back. He looks back and he introduces Baruch Shem to hedge to make sure. Why does he hedge here? What's another example where he doesn't hedge? I'll give you, none of you can answer because you're all muted and it's a pleasure. I'm just joking. I miss all of you. I miss all of your wonderful suggestions. So I'll tell you the other area. We just came off of Rosh Chodesh. Our Sephardi brothers, I don't know if we have any Sephardim right now on the call, our Sephardi brothers on Rosh Chodesh do not recite a bracha on Hallel. Let's leave out Yom Ha'atzmaut, Yom Yerushalayim. Rosh Chodesh, even on Rosh Chodesh, Sephardim do not make a bracha on Hallel. Ashkenazim all do. What's the debate? Hallel on Rosh Chodesh, is it a full Hallel or a half Hallel? It's a half Hallel. Hallel on Rosh Chodesh is a minhag. Legitimate full-fledged Hallel is the full Hallel. Hallel, which is only half Hallel, is a minhag. Do you make a bracha on a minhag? That's a machlokas, mechaber Ramah, Ashkenazim, and Sephardim. It was just true on Chol HaMoed Pesach, it's true on Rosh Chodesh. When you say half Hallel, then you're saying Hallel as a minhag. Do you make a bracha on a minhag? Is a machlokas. So does the Ramah come along and say, I'll tell you what, make a bracha on Hallel. But right after the bracha on Hallel, say Baruch Shem Kvod Machasoli Olam Va'ed, hedge, in case you weren't supposed to, say Baruch Shem, and then say Hallel. The Ramah does not hedge. So why does the Ramah hedge specifically here in Hilchos Tefillin, and he doesn't hedge in other areas of Halacha? Instead of taking a conclusive position, here he says Baruch Shem. Elsewhere we take a conclusive position, and we don't look back. Why the difference between the two? Write down that question, analyze it, research it, and get back to me. Maybe we'll look at it more closely in the future. This question about how many brachas you say on tefillin perhaps is subject to debate of what is the nature of the mitzvah of tefillin. Is the head tefillin and the arm tefillin part of one mitzvah, or are they two separate mitzvahs? And here we turn to, again, not in your source sheets. We're going to study this more closely another time. But the Mishnah in Menachos Daf Lamed Ches. The Mishnah there says that if you're lacking one or the other, it does not prevent you from filling the other part of the mitzvah. Meaning, the two types of tefillin are not ma'akvin ze'ezeh. If all you could put on are the head tefillin, or all you could put on the arm tefillin, you still fulfill that part of the mitzvah, even if you don't fulfill the rest. So God forbid a person whose arm is gangrene. God forbid a person whose arm has been amputated. God forbid a person who's paralyzed in their arm and who only is able to put on their tefillin shel rosh still fulfills the mitzvah of tefillin shel rosh, says the Gemara Menachos. And the opposite's also true. If you have some condition that precludes you from putting on the tefillin of the head and all you can put on are the tefillin of the arm, then you fulfill the mitzvah of the tefillin of the arm even though you can't put on the tefillin of the head. Azoy shteit in the Gemara Menachos Daf Lamed Ches. So for this reason, the Rambam, in Sefer HaMitzvos, Mitzvos Aseh, number Yud Gimel, 13, appropriate, tefillin, bar mitzvah, you'll never forget, Sefer HaMitzvos, mitzvah Yud Gimel, the Rambam writes, tefillin she'ad and tefillin she'ros should be counted as two separate mitzvos. In his Minyan HaMitzvos, and the Rambam is counting Taryag, the 613 mitzvos, the Rambam counts the tefillin of the head and the tefillin of the arm as two separate mitzvos. The Baal Halachos Gedolos, the Bahag, in Mitzvah Saseh number 2, says tefillin is one mitzvah. It's a yad, sharosh, ah. It's all wrapped up. It's all part of one mitzvah. What are they arguing about? So you could say they're arguing about the proper way to count mitzvos, meaning it's possible that really the dispute revolves around the question of minyan mitzvos. See, it's a Gemara in Makos, Daf Chav Gimel. The Gemara in Makos, based on a pasuk, tells us there are taryag mitzvos, the code of every Jewish person's briefcase and luggage. There are 613 mitzvos. 613. Now here's your challenge. Take Chumash, learn through Shas, and figure out how are you going to categorize what are a lot more than 613 neatly into 613 mitzvos. What are the driving principles? What are your driving rules? What are going to be the axioms, the foundations that will determine how you can look at a list much more than 613 and yet fit them in neatly to 613? So the Rambam wrote his Sefer HaMitzvos. And the Ramban wrote his Hasagos, his commentary on the Sefer HaMitzvos. And the Bahag, and the Smag, and the Smak, and the Sefer HaChinach, and many, many others all advance and put forth their own list of 613. And in the introduction, they give us what were the rules they used to arrive at their 613. So one way of understanding this machlokas between the Rambam and the Smag, and the Bahag rather, is to ask, they don't really fundamentally disagree as to the nature of the mitzvah of tefillin. What are they disagreeing about? What are the rules about how we count? And how are they disagreeing? The Rambam is of the opinion that whenever there are two components of a mitzvah, and one can fulfill either without the other, then you count them as two mitzvahs. So for the Rambam, his rule is, if you can fulfill this part of the mitzvah without the other, it gets counted as two mitzvahs. Whereas maybe the Bahag agrees that really, there's two part of one mitzvah, but if they can fulfill one without the, I'm sorry, that really there are two separate parts and you don't need to fulfill both in order to fulfill either. But however, when it comes to counting the mitzvahs, you count them as one. In the end of the day, they're tefillin. Tefillin shel rosh, tefillin shel yad. But in the end of the day, they're one mitzvah called tefillin. I could fulfill one without the other. Whatever rule of the Bahag, that rule lends itself, then nevertheless he counts it as one. So one way of understanding the machlok is Rambam Bahag. Do you count tefillin shel yad and tefillin shel rosh as two mitzvahs? Two of the 613? Or are they one of the 613? The first way of understanding it is, they're not disagreeing fundamentally of whether tefillin is two mitzvahs or one mitzvah, they're disagreeing about the rule of how you count. You with me? The second way of understanding is that no, fundamentally they're disagreeing about the relationship of the tefillin shel yad and tefillin shel rosh. And in fact, the Rashba and the Shach suggest that the question of whether there's one mitzvah of tefillin or two separate mitzvahs is a mechlokes between Rashi and Rabbeinu Tam. Is it really one mitzvah with two parts? Or are they two separate independent mitzvahs? And that's what we'll come back to more another time. We'll discuss this more at length another time. And also the whole phenomenon of the brachos. Because remember we said, even according to Svardim, how do they interpret that Gemara in brachos? When do you make a bracha lahaniach tefillin? Only if you spoke between the tefillin shel yad and the tefillin shel rosh, then you make two brachas on the tefillin shel rosh. Why should you have to do that? What do you mean? So according to Sfaradim, how do you understand that Gemara? Really, you made which bracha on the shel yad? Al mitzvah tefillin? And then if you spoke, you go back and now make two brachas, lahaniach and al mitzvah. Why are you making a lahaniach on the tefillin shel rosh? Is that going on the tefillin shel rosh? Or retroactively, that's going on the tefillin shel yad? How do we understand that? Rabbi Soloveitchik had a beautiful understanding. It appears in Eretz HaTzvi, Rav Schechter Sefer. But let's get back to our topic of Kabbalah and Halacha. And you'll remind me that I owe you this analysis. In the future, we'll do a shiur on the nature of the mitzvah of tefillin. Is it two separate mitzvahs? Is it one mitzvah? Why then do we have two brachas? Do we have one bracha? Why am I talking all about this? Why am I bringing this whole question up? Because let's go back to source number 6. Source number 6. Because the Beis Yosef in Or HaChaim, Simen Chaf Hei, says the following. Ha'agur kosov is elishon, ovani machaber, matzasi b'sefer azor, parshas Pinchas, maimedu Reb Shimon bar Yochai, de'ein levarach ha'shneim ela bracha achas. Because in an area where there are separate gemaras, gemara brachos, gemara menachos, rishonim, achronim, poskim, everybody weighs in. Well, guess who else has something to say about this? That's right, our friend the Zohar. Kabbalah also has something to say about this. So the Agur, one of the rishonim, quotes the Zohar, Parshas Pinchas, who says, he quotes a sefer, who quotes the Zohar, who says that Rav Shimon Bar Yochai teaches, tefillin inon amocha, we wear one tefillin on the head, the kabel zachar, and the tefillin on the arm, on the left arm, is opposite the heart, captures shamor. And just like zachar v'shamor, we're b'dibur echad, so too, we make one bracha on tefillin, because the head and the heart are shamor v'zachar adibur echad, so we make one bracha. And comes along the Beis Yosef, where I underline source 6 and says, sometimes the Zohar takes a conclusion opposite that of the Gemara, and when it does, we don't follow the Kabbalah. We follow the Gemara. When the Gemara has a conclusion, we follow the conclusion of the Gemara. And so on and so forth. It happens to be the Beis Yosef, the Shulchan Aruch paskin to make one bracha, but his point is that here, when the Kabbalah contradicts the halacha, then we do not incorporate the Zohar regarding how many brachas on tefillin, because it's contradicting a Gemara. Okay, let's pick up now where we left off. All this was by way of introduction and filling in some gaps. Where did we leave off? We left off where sometimes we reject the Kabbalah even when it doesn't contradict halacha. So we established when Kabbalah complements halacha, we can accept the Kabbalah. When Kabbalah contradicts the conclusion of the Gemara, we go with the Gemara over the Kabbalah. When the Gemara itself was inconclusive and Kabbalah weighs in, we incorporate Kabbalah as helping us to determine which side of the Gemara. And then we saw that sometimes Kabbalah introduces things that don't even appear in the Gemara. Lastly, sometimes we reject the Kabbalah even when it does not contradict the Gemara. And an example of that is waiting between meat and milk. Source number 13. If you're with me, you see the source sheets on the shared screen. What is the background to this? The Gemara in Chulin tells us a story. And the Gemara says, is it Marzutra? Who says, Ana Chamra, I am like vinegar, the son of wine, that I, when it comes to meat, I wait between meat and dairy the amount of time for a meal, where my father used to wait a whole 24 hours. And this Gemara is the entire source for the notion of waiting between meat and dairy. You could just not eat dairy altogether, then you never have to worry or have fear of fleshiks or wait at all. That's my preferred practice. I'm happy being fleshiks 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So, but if you do want to wait, then if you want to need to wait between meat and dairy, if you're going to lo aleinu consume dairy, then the Gemara, this is the entire sources, this one line of the Gemara, I am vinegar, the son of wine. I only wait between meals. My father waited an entire day. And here you have a big debate among the Rishonim how to understand this Gemara. How do you understand what it means, I only wait between meals? Does between meals mean, what if I'm having meals back to back? What if I'm having fleshik for a main and I want ice cream for dessert? How do you define between meals? And here you have a big machlokus between Tosos and the Rambam. The Rambam understands between meals. The Rambam writes, Kimo sheshos. Anyone here have the practice of waiting into the sixth hour? That is the Goldberg practice. I'm honored. I see my father on the Zoom. Welcome, Dad. And the Goldberg practice is to wait into the sixth hour, 5 hours plus. Some wait 5.5 hours. Others wait 3 hours. Others wait 1 hour. Others wait a good 6 hours. I don't know anyone who waits more than 6 hours. So where do all these divergent menhagim come from? Usually at most we have two menhagim, Ashkenazim, Sephardim, throw in the Taimanim for good luck, Moroccans, Ashkenazim, we're lumped together. Maybe the Yekas have their own set of menhagim. But here you have more divergent menhagim than any other practice of halacha. 6 hours, 5.5 hours, 5+, 3, 1 hour, even less than 1 hour. Where does it all come from? It comes from this debate about how to define this question. So the Rambam understands, you know what, between meals is objectively a measure. And how do you define between meals? Well, if you look at the Gemara and you see how did they space their meals in the time of the Gemara, and you have to average it because it depends on the length of a day. In the summertime, days are much longer. In the wintertime, days are much shorter. How late we go to sleep and what time we wake up is regardless of when the sun rises or the sun goes down, because we have the benefit and the gift of artificial light. But in the time of the Gemara, where they relied on sunlight, so it depends how long you have sunlight, would determine how you structured your day. So if you average it all out, you figure what the average amount of time is. So the Rambam says, Kamoshe Shos, which many interpret based on this Rambam, into the sixth hour. Others say most of the sixth hour. That's where you get 5.5 hours from. So the Rambam says that's the average space between meals, and therefore that's the average amount of time you have to wait. Why do you have to wait, by the way? The Rambam writes one reason, because when you swallow meat, it could leave residue in your throat, and if you were to swallow dairy after that, it would mix together, and therefore you would have consumed meat and dairy, a prohibition. Rashi gives a different reason, the meat stuck between your teeth. So maybe if you floss or you brush your teeth, you would eliminate that. Nevertheless, the Rambam says, between meals, kamo shesh shaos. Good. Others say that if you calculate in the winter, when take the shortest day of the year, the difference between lunch and dinner can be as little as 3 hours. And that's where we have the origin of the practice of those who wait only 3 hours. But the truth is, to a certain degree, both of those are even stringencies itself. Where do you see that from? Look at Siman Pei Tes Sif Aleph with me. Shulchan Aruch Yerideya Siman Pei Tes, paragraph number 89, says the following. Ocho basar afilo shachay v'of. If you eat meat, you had flesh. How do you define flesh? Even of a chaya or an oaf. Meaning, halachically, a chicken is not meat. That's not a big chiddush to many of you. But what do I mean by that? If you mix chicken, fowl, with milk, do you violate the biblical prohibition of basar b'chalav? No, you don't. Basar b'chalav is basar, not oaf. Oaf is a gzera we have. Why do we therefore also practice a stringency not to consume fowl with milk either? Because it's a very sensible gzera. Since the way we categorize not just us, but nutritionists and dietitians in the supermarket on their shelves and the sections, chicken goes with meat. It goes together. Fowl. So since chicken always goes with meat, if we let you eat chicken with milk, what will you likely come to eat? Meat with milk. So to prevent you from eating meat with milk, we say you can't have chicken with milk. So strictly speaking, you can. Midoraisa, biblically speaking, you can have chicken with milk. It's a gzera, a prohibition derabanan, not to have chicken with milk. So I might have thought it's a rabbinic prohibition not to have chicken with milk, so I won't eat chicken with milk. But can I have milk after chicken? Comes along the Shulchan Aruch and says no. I categorize, I include oaf and chaya, even within basar, that I can't eat gvina, I can't have dairy, acharav, ad sheyishes sheish shaos. The Mechaber says, 6 hours. Afilu im shah kashir im yesh basar ben hashinayim tzarech lasiro v'alois latinach tzarech lahamtin. The Mechaber, Rav Yosef Karo, is machmir on both reasons. He says, what if it's 10 hours later and all of a sudden you find a piece of the delicious corned beef stuck between your teeth and you swallowed it? Or the piece of corned beef is stuck between your teeth and now you want to have a cup of coffee with dairy and the dairy is going to pass through your teeth where the corned beef remains. So the Mechaber says, if there's corned beef between your teeth, you got to take it out. Also, what if you want to chew? In the antiquity, before you had baby food, they would chew on food and then feed that to their child. The chewing on food would soften it for their food, and then the child would be able to eat it. So what if the only reason that you're chewing is to be able to give it to your child, or the modern day application is you want to taste something, but you're not really swallowing it or chewing it, you're just tasting it. You're the chef, you're the cook, you want to make sure it tastes good. So nevertheless, you have to wait afterwards, says the Mechaber. So the Mechaber says, how long do you have to wait? 6 hours. And why are you waiting? He's strict for both reasons. Basar ben hashinayim, maybe it's caught between your teeth, and maybe it residue in your throat. Let's look at the Ramah. Comes along the Ramah, Rav Moshe Isserles, and he says the following. Im matza achar kach basar ben hashinayim. Let's make it bigger because we have that luxury here. And my hair is grayer than most of yours. In matza achar kach basar ben hashinayim, if you find meat between your teeth, meisiro tzarech ladiach piv kodem shiochol gvina. So you waited your 6 hours, and now you want your delicious ice cream. But before you eat your ice cream, your tongue notices that stuck in between your molar and whatever's next to it is a nice piece of corned beef, and you removed it. You better rinse out your mouth before you then consume your ice cream, because again, it could still leave its residue. Oh, here's where we get to our main point. Some say you don't have to wait 6 hours after meat before dairy. Rak miyad im sileku berech, bracha berchas amazon, mutar ayide kinuach v'hadacha. Psh! If you didn't know this, it's going to blow you away. Says the Ramah, Rav Moshe Isserles. And whom is he quoting? Tosfos and the Mordechai Nagos, Ashri Nagos, Maimoni, and the Rav Yoh. He's quoting a whole group of heavyweights, Rishonim, who all understand that Gemara, who say, what? What does it mean that you have to wait bein suda l'suda to have meat to dairy? It means, make a bracha achron, and you're done with that meal. So if I had a corned beef sandwich, I had a delicious, any British? Oh, Moshe Leib. If I had a salt beef sandwich from Reuben's, delicious, and now I want to have ice cream for dessert, do I have to wait an hour or three or five or six? No. Say Tosus, the Mordechai, that goes Ashri, that goes Maimini, the Rav Yah, you know what you have to do? Bench. If you bench, you ended one meal, rinse out your mouth, and now you're ready for ice cream for dessert. And that's the way the Ramah paskins. So make sure you listen to the end of the statement. I don't want anyone to misunderstand or misrepresent. So again, the Shulchan Aruch paskins like the Rambam, who's strict, that he says you have to wait 6 hours? Absolutely. The Ramah comes along and he redefines Bein Suda L'Suda, between one meal and another, is not defined by a time amount. It's defined how? By ending one meal and beginning the next. How do we Jews end one meal and begin the next? Through the system of our brachas. If you make a bracha achrona, your one meal is over. Make a new bracha rishona, your new meal has begun. If you want to go from meat to dairy, all you need to do is make your brachas and also rinse out your mouth, eat a cracker or a piece of bread, something which is going to cleanse your mouth. Now, how do we paskin? Do we paskin that way? Zok derama, v'aminaga pashat b'medinas eilu lahamten achar achilos habasar sha'achas. V'ochlen achar kach gvina. Says the Ramah, even though that's how we really paskin, like Tosfos, here in Krakow, here in Poland, here in Germany, we're strict. And what does being strict mean for the Ramah? What do we wait a whole hour? Really, it would have been good enough to bench and wash out our mouth. But we're strict. We wait a whole hour. Waiting that hour doesn't help if you haven't made a bracha achrona. Why? Because the bracha achrona ends one meal and begins the next. You don't have to bench in order to start your hour clock. You could start your hour clock and then bench. You need the combination of the two. The minhag is to wait an hour and bench. You could have your ice cream. If you found meat in your teeth after the hour, remove it. Don't do this on condition that you're trying to eat dairy. But you don't have to worry about that. Says the Ramah, the Poskik, Ashkenazi Jewry, wait 1 hour, you're good to go. An hour, benching and washing out your mouth. However, some are strict to wait a whole 6 hours, and that is the proper thing to do. So the Ramah throws in a curveball in his last sentence. Here he's built the whole thing up, that what? Really we paskin like the Tosfos and his teammates, who say we define between one meal and another by benching and cleaning out your mouth. Really, you don't have to wait at all. If you want to be strict, wait an hour. And that hour is a stringency. But then he ends at the end and says, wait 6 hours. Where does he get the 6 hours from? Kabbalah. Because Api Kabbalah, there's a notion of waiting that amount of time. And therefore he throws that in. So some say be strict. He quotes that. V'chei nachon lasos, it's the right thing to do. However, the Goldbergs who wait 5 hours plus, Yekas who wait 3 hours, and anyone who would wait 1 hour would be entitled to. Now, by the way, parenthetically, there are several halacha lemaisa conclusions that come out of the fact that whatever, if you're an Ashkenazi, whatever you're waiting as a chumrah. If you wait an hour, it's a chumrah. And what's a nafkamina? What if you're a nursing mother? And in order to lactate, in order to produce milk, you need to consume dairy. We'd allow you to wait less than the amount of time. You could wait an hour or even less. What if you are of iron deficiency, you would need meat. What if you have a calcium deficiency and you need to consume dairy? Or I'll give you another nafkamina. For children, we're not strict with children to have to wait ad sheyegia l'chinuch, or even then, because really, strictly speaking, even waiting at all is a chumrah above making a baruch achrona. I'll give you another nafkamina, another practical difference. What if you are fleishiks, but you forgot? So you made yourself a cup of coffee, it's only 2 hours later, but you forgot that you were fleishiks. You had salami and eggs for breakfast. No one ever eats that for breakfast, so you forgot you were fleishiks. And now you make your normal afternoon coffee, getting ready for the afternoon kailo, and you say a bracha with kavana, shakol niyeh bedvaro. Punked someone there says, what are you doing? You can't have coffee, we're fleishiks. So you made your bracha shakol, and now someone reminds you before you take your first sip. Do you take a sip? So first of all, maybe you should say, baruch shem kvod, like the old tefillin. We have the old tefillin hedge, the old tefillin trick. Maybe just say Baruch Hashem. That's not what the poskim say. Poskim say explicitly, what should you do? Take a sip of the coffee. Why? Because the whole waiting is astringency. In an effort not to take God's name in vain, take a sip of the coffee. More important to not make a bracha levatala than to uphold this minhag of waiting, when at least for Ashkenazim, those who follow the Ramah, waiting itself technically is really astringency. So this is one other area here in Halacha where sometimes we reject Kabbalah even when it doesn't contradict the Gemara. That really we do not accept that practice altogether. Ashkenazim do not all wait the 6 hours. But let me ask one footnote to this, and it's good you're all sitting down. This is going to blow you away. This only became popular more recently, but I'm going to tell you right now something. Are you ready? And this too deserves a much greater treatment. Oh, I'm not paying attention to the chat. I apologize. Where can I find the chat? Here it is. Hold on. Chat. Oh, in Holland they wait 1 hour, correct? And that's the source of it, this Ramah. In Yeshiva they only wait 5 because of the schedule of meals and learning. Good. That's also a reason. In other words, that's a technical. You've defined Bein Suda L'Suda in a formal way based on the schedule itself. So it's good you're sitting down. You ready for this? This changed my wife's life. I'll tell you, she was happy she married me just because I told her this. You ready? Coffee Mate. Anyone here drink Coffee Mate in their coffee? Coffee Mate is essentially a tube of poison, but nevertheless chemical poison that people put in their system, flavored to taste like a milkshake. It's not really coffee. I'm not trying to sound like a coffee snob, but real coffee is black coffee. Once you're adding in these creamers and every flavor under the sun, then you're drinking a milkshake. You're not really drinking coffee. But let's leave that coffee snobbery aside for a moment. So there's a whole thing called Coffee Mate. Hazelnut, French vanilla, cake flavor, whatever flavor, cinnamon, whatever you can imagine, they make a Coffee Mate flavor. And Coffee Mate is OUD. And if you look in the ingredients, you'll see that there's dairy in Coffee Mate. Rav Yisrael Belsky, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, put out a psak a few years ago that only went popular even more recently than that, that even when you're fleishiks, you can have Coffee Mate in your coffee. Psst. Changed everything. My wife is now willing to be fleishik. She used to have a fear of fleishik syndrome, never knowing when she'd want her coffee with a Coffee Mate. Now you can go fleishiks without holding back, because no problem. If you want to learn more about this, if you go on YU Torah, by Arya Leibowitz has a 10-minute halacha on this. He discusses it comprehensively, but I'll give you very quickly the quick one-minute version of why that works, and then we'll go weiter in our subject of Kabbalah and halacha. Rav Belsky's pshat, there's a few different arguments about why it should work, but Rav Belsky's reasoning is the following. He says the following. Normally we apply a principle of ein mevatlin iser lechatchila. I'm not allowed to intentionally a priori nullify or negate two food substances together, or any items together. So the dairy within the Coffee Mate is more than 1/60th of the Coffee Mate. But when you pour the Coffee Mate into the coffee, now you'll nullify whatever dairy was in the Coffee Mate within the coffee. So why are you allowed to do that? What happened to Ein Mevatlin Iser Lechatchila? So said Rav Belsky, the prohibition of Ein Mevatlin Iser Lechatchila is a prohibition that I'm not allowed to take two substances and nullify one into the other when there is a din in the cheftza, when there's a halacha in the object. Now the truth is that Coffee Mate and coffee in combination are not prohibited. Coffee's parav, and Coffee Mate has dairy. And when you combine the two, you have no cheftza shel iser. You have no prohibition. What do you have? You have a prohibition on the gavra, on the person, that they have to wait between meat and dairy. Said Rav Belsky, Eim evatlan iser lechatchila is a din in the cheftza, not a din in the gavra. The notion that you can't nullify something intentionally is a law when it comes to objects. It's not a law when it comes to people. So the obligation to wait between meat and dairy is an obligation on a person. The prohibition of nullifying intentionally is a din and a cheftza of an object. And therefore, you're allowed to put the Coffee Mate in your coffee, even though the dairy in the Coffee Mate will be nullified in the coffee. And when you drink your coffee, the coffee is parav. So a person who is fleishik can drink that Coffee Mate even if they're parav. So you'll ask, and I've been asked, does this apply to Chal of Yisrael? Will you say that the Coffee Mate or the coffee is parav to the extent that it doesn't even include Chal of Stam? That even someone who's makben in Chal of Yisrael can now drink Coffee Mate in that process? That's a good question. I don't know the answer. Got to look into that question. But in terms of if you're fleshing, being able to drink the coffee, mate, oh, mamash, my wife fell in love with me all over again when I told her that psak of Rav Belsky. If you want to understand it further, it's worth looking at and listening to Rabbi Ari Leibowitz's 10-Minute Halacha. Next, source 14, back to our topic, Kabbalah and Halacha. We are, Baruch Hashem, all over the place today. Thanks for coming on this journey with me. Let's get back on the highway. We're learning about Kabbalah, the intersection of Kabbalah and Halacha. So our first section has been Rav Yosef Karo. He saw his Beis Yosef, we saw in the Shulchan Aruch, and now we have Yosef Karo to end this off. Rav Yosef Karo, Maran, bit Yosef, in his work called the Magid Meisharim. What is the Magid Meisharim? The Magid Meisharim, in 1646, was published that 50 years Rav Yosef Karo described he had dreams, where an angel came to him in his dreams, and they would have halachic discussion. Now today, if a person told you that, you might put them away. You might put them on medication. But this is the great Rav Yosef Karo. We're talking about Maran Beit Yosef, the author of the Shulchan Aruch. So Magid Mesharim, he had dreams. The Magid, a Magid came to visit him for 50 years in his sleep. He took notes on their conversations. And after 50 years, he published their notes in 1646 under the title Magid Mesharim. And in the Magid Mesharim, it's very clear when you read the Magid Mesharim that it was not meant to be published as a work, but rather it represents or reflects his notes on those conversations with the angel, the mystical revelations. And he writes here that the mystical revelations he received played a role in prodding him to publish his Beis Yosef. Or liyom Shabbos Revi la'ad Hashem chazak va'amatz al tirav yatechas ki kol asher ata oseh Hashem matzliach kol asher asisa v'oreisa ar hayom hazem Hashem matzliach b'yadecha. So here he's recording what the Magid told him. This is Orli Yom Shabbos, on Thursday night, on the 4th of Adar Sheni. And the Magid tells him, be strong and don't waver. Hashem is causing all you do to succeed. And continue that all that you have ruled, all that you've paskined, Chen Maskima Mesifta Derekia. In the Beis Medrash upstairs, they agree with you. Chai Hashem, ki psak ze emes v'yotziv, that your psak is correct. Halacha l'moshe misina, halacha kavaseich, u'mitamecha im teshlach le'kushtanita or le'rabcha, l'chach meretz Yisrael, kulam yaskimu kavaseich. And if you were to share this psak, everybody would agree. V'gam hu ba'atzmo, mishalo ken yashiv, elofi sho nishaba, v'gam tzaz tina sho'ol b'libo, l'chein chazak v'amatz atira, ki kol asher asisa, reis arayim hazeh, hashem matzilach, and so on and so forth. And if you read down, you'll see that he encourages him to continue on this path of halacha and psak, and that he should record and publish this psak. So again, this is the end, the first section of the first attitude towards the intersection of Kabbalah and halacha is from Rav Yosef Karo. And Rav Yosef Karo, we see it in his Beis Yosef, we see it in his Shulchan Aruch, and here we see it very significantly in his Magid Meisharim. So Mirtz Hashem will pick up next week. I think we'll have one more class on this, which is the attitude of other poskim towards this very same question, the intersection of Kabbalah and Halacha. And then maybe after that, we'll come back to revisit the question of tefillin. Two mitzvahs or one mitzvah? Why two brachas or one bracha? And what is the nature of that second bracha? The Rav had a big chiddush of the nature of that second bracha. Maybe it's like lahach niso brisa shel Avraham Avinu. It's a different, it's not a birchas mitzvah, it's a different type of bracha. We'll come back to that amir tashem next time. Thank you all so much for joining. And stay exactly where you are, because you have the privilege and pleasure of now hearing from Rabbi Philip Gavriel Pinchas Moskowitz.